It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
Look closely and you'll see that unemployment insurance has several features in common with the lower tier. There is a time limit for UI benefits, much as there is for TANF, but not for Social Security or Medicare. In most years, those who remain unemployed after their benefits expire have very few other sources of public support, certainly not the jobs programs that FDR envisioned. Benefits still vary from state to state, and the differences are too large and they cannot be explained simply by cost of living.
Dr. Chris Howard, Harriman Professor of Government and Public Policy at the College of William & Mary, discusses the present and future challenges facing the unemployment system in a keynote speech given at an October 5 event at the Virginia State Capitol, sponsored by the Commonwealth Institute, marking the 75th anniversary of the unemployment insurance system in Virginia. And you'll learn what debts can and cannot be discharged in bankruptcy during this week's question and answer session. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 107, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's news you can use. Kicking someone when they're already down. It's happening all over the state to folks who are losing their homes when they probably shouldn't be. Mortgage foreclosure fraud has become so widespread that the Virginia Poverty Law Center and other groups have filed a brief with a federal appeals court to bring attention to the issue. Banks and mortgage companies are filing invalid documents at the courthouse, foreclosing on people's homes with false information or information that they have no clue whether it's true or not. Lenders also advise homeowners to stop paying their mortgages in order to qualify for a loan modification, only to find themselves being foreclosed upon anyway. On the one hand, homeowners are working with somebody at the company to modify the loan and then find out the company still is foreclosing. Virginia is a non-judicial foreclosure state, which means that a mortgage lender can foreclose on a person's home without first taking them to court. Without judicial foreclosure, it's very difficult for homeowners to fight back. Attorneys general from all 50 states are part of an investigation into mortgage foreclosure fraud, with thousands of cases currently being considered nationwide. In other news, QC Holdings, Inc., doing business as payday lender QuickCash, reports that its company earnings were cut in half to $2.04 million, compared with $4.63 million during the same third quarter in 2009, primarily due to law changes in five states, including Virginia. Legislative changes reined in payday lending in Arizona, Kentucky, South Carolina, Washington State, and Virginia, and revenue is down significantly in each of those states. However, in states where there have been no regulatory or legislative changes, third quarter results were unremarkable, with lower losses and expenses being substantially offset by reduced loan volumes compared to prior years. A new Virginia law that took effect on July 1, 2008, which limited borrowers to one payday loan at a time and doubled the amount of time borrowers had to repay the loan, drastically reduce the number of payday loans in Virginia. Due to this and changes in the other states' laws, the decline in gross profits from Arizona, Kentucky, South Carolina, Washington State, and Virginia was $5 million from the third quarter of 2009 to the third quarter of 2010. With this week's News You Can Use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
It's time for the answer to our weekly quiz called, Is That Legal? Last week, we gave you a legal question and three possible answers, one of which was incorrect. Here's last week's question. Under Virginia's motor vehicle lemon law, which two things are true? A. You have lemon law rights for 18 months after the vehicle is delivered to you. B. You have lemon law rights on all vehicles bought from a dealer, both new and used. Or C. You have lemon law rights if the vehicle can't be fixed after three tries. The correct answers are A. You have lemon law rights for 18 months after the vehicle is delivered to you. And C. You have lemon law rights if the vehicle can't be fixed after three tries. Lemon law rights exist only on new vehicles or on used vehicles that still have the original manufacturer's warranty. Later in the show, we'll give you this week's quiz. Is that legal? For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Diane Dussault.
You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio. It's time once again for this week's question and answer session. We're here in the studio with this week's questioner. Please tell us your name and where you're from.
Brandy from Richmond, Virginia.
Welcome to the show, Brandy. What question do we have this week?
Well, I have two major debts that I owe, and I was wondering if I filed bankruptcy, would either of them be taken care of?
Most likely, yes. Tell me what type of debts they are.
Well, one is my student loans, and then the second one is I owe the county of Hanover about $5,000 for a criminal violation that was turned over to a collection agency because I was unable to pay it on time.
Well, Brandy, I'm really glad I answered that question, most likely yes, because unfortunately in your case, the answer is most likely no. Let me take both of the debts one at a time. On the student loans, it is very difficult to discharge a student loan in bankruptcy. And the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit has set forth a test as to when a student loan can be discharged in bankruptcy. And the test is when the borrower faces, quote, a certainty of hopelessness. And that means basically that you are totally and permanently disabled and you have absolutely no possibility of ever being able to repay the student loan. At that point, it is dischargeable in bankruptcy. The audience can't see you, but I can. You're young, you're healthy, and there's no way you're ever going to meet, at this point, that test of a certainty of hopelessness. So no, the student loan is not going to be dischargeable in bankruptcy. On the court fines, basically those are also not dischargeable in bankruptcy. Basically, if there's some sort of a fine from a criminal law violation, whether traffic ticket or, you know, criminal conviction or even, you know, restitution involved in a criminal conviction, again, that is not dischargeable in bankruptcy. Most debts are dischargeable in bankruptcy, which is why I answered mostly true, because your credit card debts, your old utility bills, your old medical bills, most of your creditors, you can discharge those debts in bankruptcy. But these debts cannot be discharged in bankruptcy, and that's why it is really important to get competent legal help before you file bankruptcy. We strongly recommend people don't try to file their own bankruptcy, because they may do so thinking that they're going to discharge a debt that they owe, and in fact they can't do it. I know this was not necessarily the information that you wanted, but is it helpful to you?
Yes, that's very helpful. Thank you.
Okay, you're welcome. Thanks for being on the show. On October 5, 2010, the Commonwealth Institute marked the 75th anniversary of the unemployment insurance system with an event at the Virginia State Capitol, which included a keynote speech by Dr. Chris Howard, Harriman Professor of Government and Public Policy at the College of William & Mary, on the present and future challenges facing the unemployment system. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show was there, and we present you Professor Howard's remarks.
He has done extensive work on America's social policy programs, including unemployment insurance, and is the author of a number of books and the winner of a number of teaching awards for both his accessibility and excitement that he brings to the classroom. I know this from personal experience. I had him as a professor when I was in graduate school at William & Mary in public policy. And Professor Howard has a particular distinction where he suffered for 2 years the cross of having me as his teaching assistant and research assistant when I was in graduate school. And so if you treat him nicely, he may even share some war stories from that experience. But it is really a great pleasure to have someone of such national renown and expertise in this area to come to our program today and share with us all some thoughts and insights onto the history of the program.
Thank you. Mike belongs to a small but very special group of people in my life, former students who are still speaking with me. First off, I want to thank Mike for inviting me here today. His organization, the Commonwealth Institute, does important and much-needed work. I'd also like to be one of the first to congratulate Senator Watkins. Now, if I told you that I was raised in Virginia and have worked for most of my adult life in Virginia, you might expect me to stand up here and reminisce about the good old days of unemployment insurance. That's what Virginians do. We reminisce. But I can't really do that. When I look back at the history of unemployment insurance, I see a number of missed opportunities and long stretches of time when the program didn't help many of the people who needed help. In some ways, the program performs better during economic hard times, like the past few years, than it does during normal or even economic good times. Now, don't get me wrong. I believe that unemployment insurance plays a vital role in any modern society. It makes sense economically, politically, and morally. Millions and millions of Americans have been helped by this program. But over its long history, unemployment insurance has shown a number of weaknesses and shortcomings. Once you understand a few things about the history of unemployment insurance, I think you'll realize that some of the problems we see today are a painful but predictable result of choices made years ago. Now, as Mike mentioned, unemployment insurance was created in 1935 as part of the original Social Security Act. This was, most people agree, one of the biggest legislative milestones of the 20th century, on a par with the Marshall Plan or with the Civil Rights Act. Besides unemployment insurance, it created two different programs for the elderly, including Social Security, as well as aid to dependent children, what many people know now as welfare. Even though the unemployment rate at the time was 20%, unemployment insurance was one of the most controversial parts of the Social Security Act. Helping the elderly, even helping poor children, were less controversial than helping the unemployed. At the time, there were two leading models for designing unemployment insurance. The first was known as the Wisconsin Plan, and that emphasized prevention. Each employer would pay into a special fund depending on their record of laying off workers, what we now call experience rating or merit rating. The idea was to give employers a financial incentive to hold on to their workers, fewer layoffs meant lower unemployment taxes. Much of the authority under the Wisconsin plan would be left at the state level. In these ways, unemployment insurance resembled the workers' compensation laws enacted by most states during the 1910s and 1920s. The second model was known as the Ohio Plan. It emphasized income support for the unemployed. The architects of the Ohio Plan argued that experience rating would limit the monies available for benefits, making them inadequate. And they felt that few employers would be able to prevent unemployment when the economy went through a major recession or depression. Instead, they believed that employers should pay equally into a common fund and share the risks of unemployment. That fund would cover all the states and be administered by the national government. The design of the Ohio model was thus closer to Social Security than it was to workers' compensation. Now, the two plans were not complete opposites. Both excluded large parts of the workforce for political or practical reasons. The main workers covered were largely full-time factory workers. Both plans limited benefits to a few months, though the Ohio plan was a little bit more generous. And neither plan was funded in part by general tax revenues from the national government. Britain's unemployment program, in contrast, relied on a mix of payroll taxes and general revenues. Well, long story short, the Wisconsin plan won. It had the support of business leaders as well as key figures within the Roosevelt administration. They were more than a match for the labor unions and policy experts who generally favored the Ohio plan. By embracing the Wisconsin plan, elected officials in the 1930s allowed unemployment insurance to vary quite a bit from state to state, and they placed a higher priority on shaping employers' behavior than on providing adequate benefits for the unemployed. Advocates of the Wisconsin plan assumed that unemployment spells would be cyclical and usually pretty brief. Interestingly, While President Franklin Roosevelt did support the Wisconsin model, he made it clear that other policies would be needed to help the unemployed. In particular, he believed that public works projects might employ those who had exhausted their unemployed benefits but still could not find work. Unfortunately, it took a little while before unemployment insurance actually started paying any benefits. Programs had to be designed at the state level and then approved by the national government. Unemployment insurance also had to withstand legal challenges, and in 1937, the Supreme Court declared that it was indeed constitutional. Not until 1938 did many states start to issue unemployment benefits. The need was still there. After declining in 1936 and 37, the unemployment rate rose to almost 20% by 1938. Few of these people ever received unemployment benefits, though. They worked in occupations that were not covered by the law, or they hadn't worked long enough at their current job to qualify. Initially, many more of the unemployed were helped by public works programs during the New Deal. Of course, Social Security didn't benefit many people in its first years either. The larger significance of the Social Security Act was not its immediate impact, which was pretty modest. Rather, the act laid the foundation for the American welfare state. Many scholars believe that the Social Security Act created two different tiers of social programs. The lower tier was and is anchored by welfare, now called TANF. Eligibility is means-tested and thus targeted at people with low incomes. Because the states determine eligibility and benefit levels, there's a lot of variation across the country. Benefits are pretty meager, and many people who collect these benefits are suspected of being on the dole, looking for handouts, or otherwise shirking their responsibilities as parents and workers. Most programs in the lower tier are unpopular with elected officials and the general public. The upper tier is anchored by Social Security. Here, benefits are relatively generous and there is no stigma. No child that I know of gets teased on the playground because his grandma lives on Social Security. Eligibility in the upper tier is inclusive, almost universal. The national government plays a major role, which means that programs in the upper tier have a certain uniformity from state to state. Upper tier programs are popular. They grow in good times and resist cutbacks in bad times. Although many scholars think of unemployment insurance as an upper-tier program, I disagree. True, it is financed by a payroll tax, and benefits are linked to past earnings, both of which make it similar to Social Security. But that's about where the similarities end. Look closely and you'll see that unemployment insurance has several features in common with the lower tier. There is a time limit for UI benefits, much as there is for TANF, but not for Social Security or Medicare. In most year, those who remain unemployed after their benefits expire have very few other sources of public support, certainly not the jobs programs that FDR envisioned. Benefits still vary from state to state, and the differences are too large and they cannot be explained simply by cost of living. Finally, look at the percentage of the unemployed who actually receive unemployed benefits. In recent decades, less than 40% of the unemployed have been collecting benefits. In an economy where many people change jobs quickly or work part-time, it's hard to qualify for benefits. The 40% figure is quite comparable to the percent of families who are eligible for TANF and actually receive it. It is much, much lower than the percentage of the elderly who are eligible for Medicare and Social Security and who collect those benefits. I don't believe that unemployment insurance is forever destined to have these problems, but I do think that its original design helps to perpetuate these problems. In particular, the lack of involvement by the national government has really hurt the program. That's not as evident now because the national government has been paying, at times reluctantly, for extended benefits. In more normal times, the national government is very much a secondary player. Now, I don't think the only long-run solution is to run unemployment insurance like Social Security, with all funding and all authority at the national level. Washington could set higher standards that all state programs would have to meet, or it could do more to supplement the unemployment trust funds on a regular basis. State governments are pretty well equipped to handle functions like education and roads that don't change much when the economy is good or bad. But states have considerable trouble with programs that need money at precisely the moment when state revenues are flat or falling. Unemployment insurance is certainly one of those programs. We've tried for 75 years to work within the framework established by the Social Security Act, and I don't know many people who would call the history of unemployment insurance a smashing success. The last 2 years, millions of Americans have discovered firsthand how hard it is to survive when you're out of work. If every crisis brings opportunity, it's probably time for us to think of better ways of helping unemployed workers and their families.
You've been listening to Dr. Chris Howard, Harriman Professor of Government and Public Policy at the College of William & Mary, discussing the present and future challenges facing the unemployment system in a keynote speech given at an October 5 event at the Virginia State Capitol, sponsored by the Commonwealth Institute, marking the 75th anniversary of the unemployment insurance system in Virginia. This is the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. Welcome back to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
It's time for our weekly quiz called, Is That Legal? We give you a legal question and three possible answers, one of which is incorrect, and we give the correct answers next week. If you're the first to email the two correct answers, we'll post your name on our show's website and send you a free copy of the Virginia State Bar's Handbook on Your Legal Rights and Responsibilities. Here's this week's question. Which two things are true about the Federal Occupational Safety and Health Agency, or OSHA? A, you may notify OSHA or your employer about workplace hazards. B, you may ask OSHA to keep your name confidential. Or C, you may file a complaint with OSHA within 90 days of retaliation or discrimination by your employer for making a safety or health complaint. If you know the two correct answers, email them by Friday to marty@cvlas.org and be next week's winner. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Michelle King.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show ever broadcast is now available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral 4, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wegbright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. The U.S. has the most comprehensive system of assistance for veterans of any nation in the world. Join us next Wednesday at 12:30 p.m. when our guest, Mark Matthews, adjunct professor of law and managing attorney of the Veterans Benefits Clinic at the William & Mary Law School, explains the many forms of assistance and veterans benefits available to those who have served our nation in the military in a rebroadcast of a show originally heard on August 5, 2009. That's Law for the Rest of Us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegbright.